Welcome back to Power of Attorney Radio. I'm Wayne Zell, and with me today is my special guest, Dennis O'Sullivan. Welcome, Dennis.
Thanks a lot, Wayne.
Welcome to the show. Dennis is Managing Director at Convergent Wealth Advisors, and he's a certified financial planner with over 25 years of experience advising clients. He provides a wide range of financial planning services, including tax, investment, and retirement planning. But most importantly, and what we're going to really try to focus on a little bit today, is that Dennis specializes in working with business owners, helping them understand the personal financial impact of major strategic decisions concerning their business. And he also helps them analyze liquidity options. In other words, how to exit the business, whether or not you should retain the business, sell it, or just get in outside investment and bring in outside managers, perhaps, to help manage the business. Convergent Wealth Advisors provides financial planning services and asset management to a wide variety of clients, including business owners, investment bankers, and others. So tell me a little bit more about the businesses that you work with, Dennis. Who do you work with and why?
Well, one of the questions that we get in our industry all the time is, do we have minimums? And my answer, of course, is anywhere from zero to a billion. If you can fit in there, we can work with you. I enjoy working with business owners. Business owners are fun. Every business is completely unique. So there's never a dull moment. I think business owners are great clients for someone like myself because they delegate.
They should delegate.
If you meet someone who is not a delegator, you know that there's not much hope for growing their business because there's only 24 hours in a day. So I enjoy working with people who have built their companies by choosing great people and letting them go out and execute and solve problems and build businesses. So I'm just another piece of the puzzle. Business owners delegate their long-term planning to me. Just as they would delegate their financial controls to the CFO or their marketing to a chief marketing officer.
So most of us know about personal financial planning in the context of just planning your individual lives. You know, your husband, your wife, your spouse, your significant other, you need to sit down with them and sort of map out the rest of your life. And the financial planner does a lot of that with you and helps, you know, gauge your investment strategies and how you're going to be spending money and helps you regulate your life. Tell me a little bit more, though, on the business side, what you do with these business owners, because I think that's a unique service that's not offered by most financial planners in this area or anywhere else. And how did you acquire that experience?
That's true. One of the things you have to understand about business owners is that most of them, the vast majority of their wealth is in their business.
Right.
So sometimes you will hear financial planners correctly say that diversification is important, and it is. But let's never forget that it's concentration that makes you wealthy.
Right.
If you have 99.9% of your net worth in a company that you are building and that you believe in, that's the way to wealth. And our job is to help our clients understand what that wealth means and how to over time exit it in a reasonable and thoughtful manner. You don't want to have all your eggs in one basket, at least for your entire lifetime. And there's a time to have concentration, and then there's a time to diversify. From a strategic standpoint, our job is to figure out what your choices are with your business and then execute a plan around it. You cannot separate the individual and the business.
Right.
Your net worth, your everything that you have, your time certainly, your legacy is in that business. So you have to know business planning just as well as personal planning.
You mentioned to me before we started that you had gained some experience in the world of IPOs and during the tech bubble. I was actually in-house with a company myself, and I learned a lot about running a company. Tell me a little bit about your experience back then and how what you did, how you acquired your experience in business exit planning.
It all started with a phone call. I was working for a company that's client base was primarily corporate, Fortune 500, and at 25, I had no such clients or friends, certainly. One of my buddies was working for an early stage company called UUNet, which we all remember back in the 90s, and he called me up and said, hey, I have these things called incentive stock options. I don't know what they are. So from there, I built some expertise and some reputation among local tech companies that back in those days, the IPO was the preferred exit, and things happened very quickly. You might join a company today, it might go public 6 weeks from now,
right,
and the stock would be a wild ride. So recognizing that that was a unique event, that this was not how economics were supposed to work. It was not how the world of business normally ran. This was a unique window in our history. I helped clients make good decisions about how to make that what seemed to be paper wealth into permanent wealth. And then I took that on the road to the West Coast, and I commuted to Silicon Valley for 10 years, up until about 2001, when, of course, everything fell apart.
And you stayed close to home.
Exactly.
And retooled yourself to focus more on the government services arena, I see.
Exactly. Part of it was that I got married and had kids, so my wife said one coast or the other, buddy. But we did retool that for the government contractors sector and technology in Washington. There's a lot of great tech firms in this area that don't get as much press as they should. The federal sector is interesting because it's a little bit slower than, say, a social media company. It's a right. little bit more formulaic. What is your bottom line? And we assign a multiple. But the reality is that a good business owner recognized, especially in the federal sector, it's not just about your contracts. It's not just about your agency relationships. Acquirers are looking for well-branded, well-managed companies. And if you've done your job right, you've replaced yourself so you don't have to stick around.
Exactly. I mean, that's the entrepreneur's biggest weakness, I think, is that they believe that they are the only ones that should be and can run their company. And the good entrepreneur who's really gauging up for a business exit, and tell me if you disagree, is one who surrounds himself or herself with a good management team and that basically can continue the business if they get hit by the proverbial bus.
Exactly. Every acquirer wants a good management team. I've been to so many management meetings where one presents one's company to potential acquirers, and the first question always is, what happens if you're gone? Are you going to stick around? If you've taken the time to develop a maturing C-level of CFO, CEO, what have you, of experts that have replaced you, essentially, then not only are you going to increase your valuation, but you're going to be able to exit the business. What you don't want to have happen is a situation where you have to stick around because you're the secret sauce, but you don't own the company anymore. So what have you really accomplished if you've done that?
Particularly in the services sector, that is very, very important advice. So we're talking with Dennis O'Sullivan, who is the managing director at Convergent Wealth Advisors. And Dennis is talking to us about selling, exiting businesses. When should an owner start considering the exit? When is the appropriate time?
So there's one particular point in time where the business owner realizes that they either have to look for outside investment, they have to sell the company, or they have to start investing in that next generation of management. We debate different numbers around my firm, but I believe that when a federal contracts firm gets to, say, 15 or 20 million on the top line, perhaps, that's where they simply can't do everything themselves. They have to have a full-time CFO. They probably need a fairly solid, deep bench on business development, perhaps a CEO. The best founders are usually not the best CEOs. So when you come to that inflection point and you have to start making decisions about, well, I've got to spend $500,000 on the C-suite, which could otherwise go in my pocket, or I need to sell it, or I need to look at other options. It's usually the person who calls me has been working 18 hours a day.
Right.
They're the expert in a particular agency or capture or proposals, and they can't do it anymore. It's a little bit like my long commute back in the day. When you're 20 or 30, you can do that sort of thing. But when you're in your 40s or 50s and you have other things that you're interested in, maybe it's time to start talking about that.
I don't disagree with you. I agree with you 100%. Being in my middle 50s, I can definitely attest to that. For owners of government contracting firms, what's different about the exit planning for them versus owners who are in the IT space or the commercial space that don't do government contracting?
Well, sure. I think multiples. When you talk to an investment banker, for instance, the first thing they tell you is what your multiple is. And it's a little bit formulaic, and it's a little bit of a way just to ask, start the conversation. But technology companies have a different math. What's the multiple for Instagram or Twitter? They've never made any money, so there's no multiple.
Especially Twitter.
Exactly. So they have a different, there's a different way of buying those companies and valuing those companies. It's a little bit aspirational rather than reality. Government contract firms, there's, for better or worse, there's a pretty good established formula out there. We look at your bottom line profits. We make some adjustments, assuming the owner's gone. And then we look at the strength of the agency relationships. And then the market, Mr. Market, has assigned a, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 times that multiple. That is just the starting point. If you happen to have a great brand, great management, you know, a big backlog, et cetera, you might get more. If you don't have any of those things, and you know, certainly if you have contracts that are not full and open, you're going to get a heavy discount. So the multiple is really a way to start the conversation about what you might be worth. And that's really the conversation I have with clients. So we can just sort of get a back of the envelope of what we're talking about. If you tell me you want $60 million to sell your company, but we do the back of the envelope and it's worth 20, we got to make some strategic decisions. How do you get to the 60, or should you do something entirely different?
Yeah, I think valuation is as much of an art as it is a science, and people get wedded to these multiples. They'll hear, you know, 3 times, 8 times, 9 times EBITDA, that which is earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. I don't necessarily believe that that applies across the board. You can't, even in the government contracting sector, the valuation folks that I work with and work closely with, you know, really evaluate a lot of things, including whether or not you've got processes, whether what technology you may have developed, or any kind of trade secrets that you've got that are unique to your business, any types of software that may not be patentable, but, you know, right, other things that, that you bring to the table that the strategic buyer may be particularly interested in. Let me ask you a question. There's a difference between a strategic buyer and a financial buyer. Could you elaborate a little bit on that for us?
Of course. And this has become very important in the last 10 years or so. A strategic buyer wants your company because it's a great fit for what they're already doing.
Right.
So,
or what they may not be doing.
Or they may not be
but
doing.
But they want to do.
I sell Coca-Cola and you're a bottler. Okay. You fit in perfectly with me. You know, there's a million examples of that sort of thing. But I want to get into a particular market or a particular agency. I right. want to do something that will increase my visibility, my revenue, and hopefully my profits. It might be a technology. It might be your software. We have a lot of what we're calling acqui-hires these days, which means that I want your people. The best engineers, the best people in a lot of areas are hard to come by.
So, highly cleared.
Highly cleared. That's right. Huge in Washington.
Yes.
So I want something that you have. And that's where valuation gets more interesting, because then it's really what we can negotiate.
Right.
I think my software is going to change your company. You think it's pretty good, but not that good, so we can negotiate. A financial sponsor is buying you as an asset to produce returns for its investors.
Right.
So most financial sponsors are what we call private equity firms. And the private equity world has exploded the last 10 years, partially because I think people don't trust the public markets as much as they used to after the 2008 and 2009 debacle. Institutions have trillions of dollars on their balance sheet, pensions, and your university and my university for their endowments, and they're trying to put this money at work. They start hearing about government contracts firms where they're getting 8-9% margins, and they're saying, wow, the client has their own printing press. We see 5 years out. We have a set of economics that applies only to government, nowhere else. That's a pretty good deal. Of course, you and I know it's not that easy, but
and contracts are cancelable at convenience. I mean,
exactly.
Generally.
So,
and lately, it's become a little bit scarier in the government market, hasn't it?
Sure. So you have these sort of macro events like sequestration or the debt crisis, and people start getting really, really worried about that. So it is a dangerous territory if you don't know what you're doing, but there have been some great private equity firms that have made a lot of money for their clients.
Absolutely, and they know what they're doing. So we're talking with Dennis O'Sullivan, and Dennis is Managing Director at Convergent Wealth Advisors. Dennis, if people want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
The best way to reach me is my email, which is Dennis with one N, O'Sullivan at convergentwealth.com. Independence.com also works. And If you're selling a company, call me on my cell phone, 540-207-8222.
Thanks for being a special guest on Power of Attorney Radio today.
My pleasure, Wayne. Thank you.
And everyone, thanks for listening in. I'm Wayne Zell. And by the way, don't forget to check out my blog at www.blueprintforwealth.org, where I've got a compendium of articles, videos, and audio, including these past shows, on topics of interest in tax, estate planning, and business planning. I hope you all have a great week. Talk to you next week.